What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Weekly. It's Wednesday, December 10th, 2025. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about Five Nights at Freddy's 2. We'll follow up on our Last Frontier conversation from earlier this year and present an interview with that show's showrunner. We'll touch on the new spoof comedy Facom Hall and present an interview with that movie's director. And we'll wrap things up with a new interview with Dogma writer-director Kevin Smith. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com. And as you probably know, there's a really big news item that we need to talk about here. There are some other news items that I thought were interesting. Vin Diesel is writing a Rock'em Sock'em Robots movie. There's a Clue scripted series in the works over at Peacock. Scarlett Johansson has joined Robert Pattinson in The Batman 2. There's some other stuff. I'm going to link to those items in the show notes so you can check this out. But we have to talk about what's going on with Warner Brothers. Paramount was, I think, widely considered the leader in this race to acquire Warner Brothers. And that seems to not have gone well for them because Netflix announced, this was late Thursday night, early Friday morning, that Netflix has entered into a definitive agreement under which Netflix will acquire Warner Brothers, including its film and television studios, HBO Max and HBO. So this is a little different than what Paramount was offering and what they wanted. They wanted to buy the entire Warner Brothers Discovery company, which includes some linear TV networks and some cable channels and stuff that are pretty quickly losing value. But Netflix has come in and just said, all right, we're just buying Warner Brothers, the film studio, and then the TV stuff. So Paramount has now come back over the top and has raised its bid and is saying, no, we'll actually pay more for this. And they're going around the board and going straight to Warner Brothers shareholders and trying to convince them that no, Paramount is the way to go. So what I want to do here is try to lay out what could happen if either of these companies ends up closing this deal, because there's still a lot that has to happen here. There's a lot of regulatory stuff that has to happen. If this deal goes through with Netflix, as it's been announced in the press, that's not going to happen until the third quarter of 2026. So there's a little while to go there. But I think this is going to be something where lawsuits are going to be filed and this is going to get really ugly and really messy. And it's going to take many, many, many months to figure out exactly what's going on. So this is early days still. But just to kind of present you with a snapshot of where we are in time, I wanted to run down what might happen if each of these companies ends up winning this prize here. So if Netflix wins, expect your monthly Netflix bill to skyrocket. It'll probably be a small bump at first, but by effectively absorbing HBO Max into Netflix, that's how the company is going to increase its revenue, by charging you the highest amount of money that their models predict you will pay, and then slowly increasing that over time when Wall Street inevitably tells them that they need to continue to grow forever, because that's apparently the business model that we're all living in under capitalism these days. Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO of Netflix, has been very vocal about saying that theaters are an outdated concept, and he's done a lot of work to devalue the theatrical experience over the past 15 years. He's saying that if this deal goes through, Netflix will continue to release movies in theaters, including the Warner Brothers films, but reports indicate that once Netflix has actually completed the contractual obligations of existing Warner Brothers movies, or ones where contracts have already been signed, the studio is going to drastically cut the theatrical window for Netflix and Warner Brothers movies. Historically, major theater chains have not shown Netflix movies in theaters because the window that Netflix offers is too short. Theaters traditionally need a period of exclusivity to help sustain their business. But if Netflix buys Warner Brothers and takes control of a significant percentage of the overall number of annual theatrical releases, Sinners, Weapons, Final Destination, Bloodlines, the list goes on. And if Netflix decides, hey, instead of these movies being in theaters for 45 days and then going to VOD, like what happens now, we're going to put them in theaters for only 17 days, and then we're going to drop them straight on Netflix. if that happens, AMC and the other theater chains won't have any leverage to be able to fight against it. And if they give in and start playing movies with that short of a window, that's pretty much a wrap on the theatrical experience as we've known it so far. A gigantic number of movie theaters across this country will have to close. Netflix will probably continue to make a decent amount of money in theaters from the first few weekends of big releases, but they'll say that they will value the convenience of having the movies go on the platform quickly more than whatever money they could make by leaving the film exclusively in theaters for a longer amount of time. And that would just be devastating to a theatrical exhibition business, which is already on thin ice as it is. It's going to be a historic foundation-shaking loss that we're talking about here. And the downstream effects of what might happen there are almost too big to even fathom right now. Like, what kinds of movies will get greenlit if the theatrical experience is now a secondary thing? What does that do to the type of storytelling that makes it through the system? And I know some people will scoff at this, but what happens to DC movies, for example? Would a film like James Gunn's Superman, which I loved earlier this year, have the same access to that level of budget and marketing under a new regime? Are those movies, those big superhero movies, about to scale down in a big way? Would we ever see anything like One Battle After Another ever again? Or, as Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times recently suggested, does the medium of cinema, does cinema as we know it, even survive this long term? So far, history has shown that Ted Sarandos wants you to spend as much time as possible on the streaming service. That's Netflix's primary business model. And if that's the case, doesn't it make the most financial sense to invest resources into the HBO side of things, greenlight fewer movies, and make as much long-form stuff as possible to keep you on the service for as long as possible? A 12-hour series seems much more valuable to Netflix than a 2-hour movie. So that's what might happen if Netflix wins. If Paramount wins, they will get everything that Warner Brothers Discovery is offering right now, which is the linear networks, the cable channels, and the film and TV stuff, the major studios. So Paramount, this new organization with Warner Brothers sucked into it, will almost certainly be in thrall to our profoundly transactional president. We've already seen Paramount make a payment to this administration that certainly seemed like it was greasing the wheels for Skydance's acquisition of the studio a few months ago when the whole Stephen Colbert situation happened. They have since installed Barry Weiss as the head of CBS News, which many people have said has completely gutted the journalistic standing that organization has held for decades. They have agreed to release Rush Hour 4 because the president asked them to. And if this deal goes through, the Ellisons will then own CNN, which, according to the Wall Street Journal, David Ellison offered assurances to Trump officials that if he buys Warner Brothers, he will make major changes to CNN for the Trump administration. So effectively, this combined company would be a form of state-sponsored media. That means movies with any hint of progressive ideology in them might have a tougher time getting a green light. And with Paramount taking Warner Brothers off the board, that's one less place filmmakers have to pitch their projects around. There are also going to be lots more people fired if Paramount wins this. Paramount has said it will have something like $6 billion in cost-cutting measures, most of which will come from people being laid off. Paramount and Warner Brothers have employees right now, as they operate as separate companies, who do the same job. And if this deal goes through, a huge percentage of those people are going to be fired. Meanwhile, Netflix plans to have only around $3 billion, I think, in cost-cutting measures. So more people will keep their jobs because there are less redundancies, since Netflix and Warner Brothers don't have the same type of similarities that Paramount and Warner Brothers do. But will saving those studio jobs in the short term end up meaning that more people overall are ultimately out of work because of what will happen to theaters? I don't know. This whole situation really sucks. It really doesn't seem like there's a great option here, but that's kind of where we are right now. And again, this is like very, very early days, and this is going to be a conversation that we're having for a long time. So I just wanted to provide a little bit of a baseline for where we are, because I'm not going to recap all of that every time we give an update on this thing. So hopefully everybody understands kind of where we are in the magnitude of what this is going to mean for Hollywood as we know it, and maybe the theatrical exhibition industry as we know it. This is very much, it feels like the end of something big. It feels like a line in the sand moment. And we're going to be covering this in a pretty serious way at Slash Film. So stay tuned to this podcast and to slashfilm.com for more information on that. And with that, let's take a quick break and then we'll jump into our movie and TV conversations. With me now is Slash Film editor BJ Colangelo.
Hi.
All right, BJ, I'm going to be honest with you. I was planning on seeing Five Nights at Freddy's 2, so you and I could have a normal conversation about it, like two regular moviegoers. And then I heard that this movie was very, very bad. And so I decided to be selfish and not go see it in theaters. And you kind of took the bullet on this one for me. So do you agree with the people that I've seen who are calling this an atrocious movie?
Before I say how I feel about this movie, let me preface this by saying I love Five Nights at Freddy's. Unironically, I love the games. I love what he represents as the new generation's gateway into horror. I love the like ridiculous community that has been built in people trying to make sense of the lore of these games. Like, so if there is any critic out there who is going to be primed to love these movies, it's me. But with that being said, this movie is a hot ass mess.
Oh, no. Okay.
Oh, well, my God. I was so upset because I genuinely think that there is like 15, maybe 20 minutes, if I'm being generous. That is such an awesome time. But it is flanked by absolute nonsensical bullshit that doesn't make any sense. It is atrocious and insulting to the intelligence of everybody watching the movie, including the people who love these games.
Well, the thing is, you're familiar with the games, right? Like, you've played several movies.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I've played, like, almost all the games at this point. And during the first movie, people who might not remember this, I was, like, one of two people on the Slash Film staff who knew anything about Five Nights at Freddy's. So I ended up writing, I think it was, like, 20-something articles in, like, the week that the movie came out. Because I'm the only one who knew anything. So I did, like, a massive explainer, trying to make sense of a lot of the lore, the history of how these games came to be, how they became popular. Like, I'm very immersed in this world and in this community, and I think that that knowledge is the only reason I could make any damn sense of this movie. If you don't know this stuff, I don't know how anyone is going to follow along.
Yeah, we have an article. Whitney Siebold wrote an article for us that I believe is up on the site by the time people are listening to this, that basically says, I am not familiar with the games and I'm just totally baffled by this movie. And so I read that piece and it seems like there are some references to the lore and stuff like that. And in my mind, I was like, well, there are references to Easter eggs and all that kind of stuff in Marvel movies and things like that. But I think the idea being put forth here is that those films function. We don't have to understand all of that stuff. You don't have to bring in all of this outside knowledge to understand. Like, if you just watch Iron Man and a handful of these other movies or whatever, you'll pretty much get what's going on. And it sounds like that's not necessarily the case for somebody who just watches Five Nights at Freddy's, the first movie, and then goes into the second movie. It seems like that should be like a self-contained enough universe for people to understand what's going on, but it sounds like that's not really happening. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, so my thinking on it is this. So the first movie had Scott Cawthon, who is the creator of all these games. Like, he's created all of it. This is his baby. He was one of the co-screenwriters along with the director Emma Tammy and this writer Seth Cuddleback. So he was writing with actual screenwriters. The second movie, he has sole writing credit. Now, of course, we know that means there are some other people who have probably, you know, contributed or helped in some way, because that's how all movies are made. But he does have sole writing credit on this movie. And so what ends up happening is this movie feels like he is trying to take the years of lore and Reddit comments and whatever that he's gotten over the years from, you know, what the fandom has to say about this, about the games, and he's trying to shove it in the hole of the movie's canon, because the movie's canon does like delineate from the game canon, and they did that on purpose. But now it feels like he's trying to unite them in a weird way, and instead of it being cohesive, it just feels like two action figures being slammed together. Like, it just doesn't work. And so there are characters that show up and then it's like, here's a big reveal of who this character is. And it's like, but if you don't know the game lore, this has no weight. That like, this isn't cool. Like it, he doesn't know how to build these characters up outside of, I just expect that you already know that this person's important. But if you don't know that already, like it has such a weird thud to it. Like this is going to be such a weird reference. Have you ever seen the Black Christmas remake from 2006?
You know, I did see that at the time, but I have not revisited since then.
Okay, so I use this reference a lot, and apologies for people who've never seen this movie, but Black Christmas 2006, or Black Xmas, as it is called, there is this moment where there's a, like the camera is pulling away. It's like this big dramatic push in, and it's clearly like a character reveal. Like, oh my God, we are going to see this big character reveal. And she turns around and she's like, I'm so-and-so's sister. And like, it's not a cameo. It's not a reference to somebody from the original Black Christmas. It's just another actor. Like, that's it. So it has this like ramp up that's supposed to feel like really big and really important. And then it just hits like a whimper to the point of like laughing. Cause it's like, who the fuck is that? I don't know who that is. And like, that is how this entire movie operates. Like, there are so many people that just show up randomly and it's like, da 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 da, it's this guy. And it's like, well, who the fuck is that guy?
And you didn't even know who that person was as a game?
Well, here's the thing.
As somebody familiar with the games?
As the person familiar with the games, I did know who they are, but like it didn't matter to me because it was like, well, this doesn't make sense in the movie. Like, I know who this is, but the movie doesn't make them ever feel important. Like, it's just, here it is. If you know, you know, and it doesn't work. Like, cinematically, this does not work. You cannot tell a story this way.
It's Star Trek Into Darkness syndrome, right? With the whole Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan
thing,
where like you have to know what that, you have to be at least familiar with some of the source material going back, you know, well before the 2009 movie to understand who the hell Khan is and why that matters. But the movie treats it as a huge reveal. And same thing with like Dave Filoni and like pandering to this corner of the Star Wars universe with these Ahsoka shows and like bringing in all these characters. And it's like, if you've never watched Star Wars Rebels or any of these animated shows, I feel like you gotta just like meet people where they are when they're coming to this stuff. And I don't know, I'm not sure if it's like people pandering to fandom that is the problem, because it sounds like that's the case with Filoni, and it sounds like that might be the case here. I don't know why this keeps happening over and over again in pop culture. This is like driving me nuts.
It's so weird. And so I have a piece that'll be coming out on, I guess, Friday. So whenever people are listening to this, about how I think the fact that he has creative control over these movies, which like that has been confirmed by Blumhouse, that Scott Cawthon has creative control, I think is a terrible decision, because I very much subscribe to the storytelling rule set by Trey Parker and Matt Stone, which is that you should never have and connecting your story beats. It should always be but or therefore. So they're always connected. So all of your story, it's never this happened and then this happened and then this happened. It's like, no. This happened, but then this happened. Therefore, this happened. So that way your story always makes sense. This movie is nothing but ands. This happened and then this happened and then this happened. And like none of it is cohesive at all. And it's so frustrating because all of this is happening at the same time as like legitimately the most impressive animatronics I've ever seen in my life. Like they are so spectacular and so cool, and they're utilized really well. And Megan Fox voices Chica, and she's really great, like a really great voiceover performance for the limited time that they utilize her. And so it's like this movie has all of the parts to be really, really cool. And it just doesn't happen because this script is bonk as hell.
Man, that's a huge bummer. Yeah, even Whitney, who is like, as I alluded to, just completely baffled by this movie, admitted in, I think, a couple of his pieces that the effects, the practical effects with the animatronics and everything just look great in this movie. So I guess if people like watch it later, at home on mute or something, that might be the best way to engage with the story, unfortunately. But
yeah, it's as many of us were saying as we left our press screening, like a third act, No, Scott Cawthon don't know her. It just doesn't have a third act. And it there's so many cliffhangers and loose plot threads. And I've seen some interviews where, you know, the creative team has been like, oh, we're going to pay that off in the third movie. And it's like, okay, but you still have to make a second movie. And this is not a movie. Mm-hmm. This is just stuff happening recorded in front of a camera.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the bullet for me, BJ, and telling our listeners a little bit about this movie. But where else could people find you online if they're looking for more of your stuff?
Oh, I mean, I'm all over the place. Slash Film, Fangoria, my podcast, This Ends at Prom. I'm everywhere. And I hate to say it, as much as I didn't like this movie, I stupidly am still very hopeful for the third installment. Like, please just rally. I love this franchise so much. Just let it happen.
All right. Yeah. Maybe they can learn some lessons and come back and surprise everybody. So,
God, I hope so.
All right. Thanks, BJ. With me now is Slash Film staff writer Jeremy Mathai.
Hey, folks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So, Jeremy, you and I are here to talk about The Last Frontier, which is the Apple TV show that debuted a couple months ago now. And the reason we're talking about the show again is because back then, when we played your interview with Jason Clark, you also had the chance to talk to John Bokenkamp, who is the showrunner of the series, and you get into some spoilery details that we wanted to hold until the season was over. So now we've reached that point, and I guess we can say spoilers now for The Last Frontier. I have not had a chance to catch up with the show yet, but I know what happens just from editing some pieces that you wrote at Slash Film. But I wanted to give you a platform to talk about the show sort of in all of its glory without having to hold back at all because of spoiler stuff. So what do you think about the way that the series wrapped up? And what do you think about, because I haven't seen it, is it even possible for there to be more seasons of this? Like, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, so it was actually a little tough to talk about this the first time around when we did this on the podcast on October, I think, just because so much of the show is built on what happens in the middle and later parts of the season. It is just a show that is, you know, built on spoilers for the most part. But now at this point, you know, we can talk about how the main trio of, you know, basically Jason Clark's Frank Remnick, Haley Bennett's Sidney Schofield, Dominic Cooper as the guy, he's the presumed villain, but codenamed Havelock, set up as the villain of the show. And it turns out, you know, him and Sidney have kind of been in cahoots against the CIA from the beginning, from the most part, even before the events of the show began. And it's just kind of been a pleasure watching how this season kind of builds towards these series of reveals that happen in towards the second half of the season. And it's kind of, I think, like I said the first time I was on here talking about the show, I do think the ending was worth the ride, in the sense that, you know, and I do talk about this with the showrunner John Bokenkamp in interviews, just the push and pull of having to just kind of delay all of these reveals, kind of withhold information from audiences, kind of as long as possible, but without frustrating viewers either at the same time, which, as we know, you know, I'm sure we're all big fans of Lost here back in the day, and like that show kind of rode the line pretty, you know, almost over to the edge of just, you know, getting that balance right. I mean, it's just so difficult. And for the most part, I do think The Last Frontier kind of just pulled that off towards the very end, at least, once, you know, everything kind of clicks into place and then you kind of see where all this has been building in my view, at least, a satisfying enough conclusion.
Okay. Are multiple characters left alive at the end of this whole thing? Do you think there's any potential story left to tell here, or do you think this is a one and done season?
Yeah, so the finale, I'd say the last 3 minutes of the finale does tee up a potential season two. You know, it all kind of ends with Sydney in custody after the reveal that she was the one responsible for bringing down the plane crash in the first place. Obviously, she had her justifications for doing it. She felt that she was doing it for the greater good, even though she was condemning Havelock, who we learn is her lover, not just her lover, her husband. In a series of reveals, I think in episode 8, is that it's pretty much an hour-long flashback going into their backstory and relationship. But she ends up in custody. Havelock disappears. He's presumed dead, but he's obviously escaped again. And as she's being led away, presumably to prison, we see Havelock contacting Frank over the phone and kind of taunting him, kind of goading him, and saying that, you know, we have some unfinished business. We'll be back, you know, we have, there's still plenty more to be done. And then him and his goons are basically just about ready to break Sidney out of prison. So I did talk to John Bokenkamp about this as well. And he played coy about whether Apple had kind of greenlit a season two based on how well season one performs. He wanted to focus on, you know, the satisfying conclusion of season one, focusing on the characters and that sort of thing. I do get the sense that they were very much interested in continuing the story. It would be kind of, it wouldn't be necessarily be a cancellation if a season two doesn't happen. I don't know if they ever marketed this as more than just a limited series to that extent, but it does seem like they were gearing towards a season two. And I could very much see a way forward for that to happen if the powers that be decide to go that route.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, Apple is pretty known in the industry for quietly handing out two-season renewals or green lights like pretty quickly for a lot of shows, and like keeping the second season quiet until, you know, a few months after season one wraps up. So he may have been just, yeah, playing with you a little bit and kind of like trying not to reveal things too early or whatever. I don't know if that's necessarily like applies to every single show or if that applies to this show or what, but I just wanted to kind of give people some context for how Apple has historically operated, I think. All right, well, is there anything else you think we should say about the show before we just dive into your conversation?
No, I think we can pretty much just tape the conversation here. I remember talking to John Bokenkamp about, you know, whether the show is, I described it as kind of pulp versus prestige, which he reacted very favorably towards. I think that's exactly kind of what they were going for on this. The, you know, it's kind of between the serialized and episodic storytelling, there's sort of like, we talked about this previously, there's like an inmate of the week storyline throughout each episode that they kind of seed through there. They cast Johnny Knoxville of Jackass fame for one of those inmate roles earlier in the season, which is just, it was just amazing watching him pop up on screen and be pretty convincing as kind of this hard-edged criminal with a pretty violent backstory. So yeah, I think we, within the span of however many minutes we were able to talk, we kind of dug deep into the season overall, the finale especially, some of the spoiler things towards the end, but I think it was a great conversation and I think you'll enjoy it.
Cool. Yeah, I would not be mad if Johnny Knoxville started popping up in more supporting roles. I remember that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, The Last Stand, from 2013 or something. Johnny Knoxville played like sort of a sidekick to Schwarzenegger's character. I remember him being like pretty entertaining in that capacity. So yeah, it's been a little while since I've seen him in anything outside of a Jackass context, but I would definitely welcome the return of Johnny Knoxville supporting character actor type of thing. So
he tends to understand the assignment, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, here is Jeremy's conversation with John Bokenkamp, the showrunner of Apple TV's The Last Frontier.
Whenever I sit down to watch a new show these days, I'm kind of playing a little game with myself to see which category it falls into. Prestige or pulp? And I kind of feel like The Last Frontier is a little mix of both.
Yeah.
That's just me. What do you think?
I love that. I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah. I mean, this is definitely pulpy. This is supposed to be fun, right? Like, there's a lot of prestige. There's a lot of smart TV. Sometimes I feel like I'm needing to eat my vegetables and some of the things I'm watching that I'm supposed to reflect back on how I feel and where the world is. This is supposed to give people a place to escape, to forget about the world for a little bit and have some fun. So that is the pulp side. The prestige side, look, we have Jason Clarke and Haley Bennett and Dominic Cooper and some great writers and Apple TV Plus. So I think we're trying to take what is perhaps a pulpy idea and ground it as much as we possibly can. And that's a interesting space.
Yeah, I love that about it. Yeah, another thing I appreciate, I'm always, you know, a fan of kind of throwback TV. I kind of yearn for those days when it's kind of episodic. And I feel like, again, The Last Frontier kind of has a mix of both, where it's obviously serialized. It has that ongoing story. But there's also, you know, with the cold open for every episode, it's kind of like the inmate of the week that they have to, Frankenstein, have to deal with. Was that a conscious decision?
Absolutely. I'm glad that resonates with you. We tried very hard to have each episode, it's almost like each episode's its own little movie. Each inmate represents sort of a different world, you know, whether it's some crazy doctor who was murdering his patients or, you know, a grifter or a con woman, you know, those, I think each one of those characters gives each episode a little bit of a different flavor. And yes, we do have that larger ongoing conspiracy, I guess I'd say it's more of a espionage sort of story underlying everything.
Now, part of that is also you have tremendous guest actors every single week. Johnny Knoxville, you got.
Yeah,
you know,
how about that?
Can you? What is the story behind that? How do you get all of these amazing?
Well, we got lucky. We have great casting, but I'll tell you, Johnny Knoxville, he started emailing me. We got to know each other. And he started emailing me about another one of the actors who had really some kind of concerning ideas about what they wanted to do with the character and like wardrobe choices and things that made no sense the weather. And I was about to confront the other actor and I realized he was completely screwing with me. And I felt so stupid and yet so honored that I had been had by Johnny Knoxville. But yeah, we have a great cast and week to week, I think each episode, again, they're great from our core cast all the way to Alfre Woodard. I mean, it's just we're very fortunate with our cast. I think it's a great reason for people to tune in.
I agree. Now, to dive into spoiler territory.
Yeah, cool.
This season, you and Richard kind of made the choice to sort of withhold the tragic backstory regarding Frank and his family and the secret that he had. You know, these days you have mystery box shows and that has connotations to it. What went into the choice to kind of slow play that reveal until later in the season rather than, you know, showing having a flashback or a monologue ahead of time
up front
and just showing us, you know, exactly what went on?
Well, I think, look, I love a good, as much as the show is fast and as much as the show is sort of filled with adrenaline, I also love slowing things down and sort of taking our time to get somewhere. And that character with Frank, I think he presents as such a noble sort of throwback kind of person. He has his own sort of moral code and yet even that's flawed, you know? And so by the time we unpack what that story is, what it means to him, I think it just informs, you know, he's carrying guilt because of what this is. His daughter died because of something he did, because of the one time he crossed the line. And he's been, I think it resonates, and maybe the reason to hold it till later is he's spoken for so long about doing the right thing and being an upstanding person. But the one, as a cop, the one person he couldn't protect was his own daughter. And I think it's an important time in the season, important part of the season for us to sort of take a breath and reflect back on who he is and recalibrate everything before we go off into the last part of the season.
And when that flashback hits and you see what happens to Ruby, like that hits like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, good.
And
good.
That was, you know, was that part of the plan all along to save it for like later in the season?
Yeah.
And then kind of just.
Yeah, we always knew we knew there were some flashbacks with Sydney and Havelock and going back to see who they were before.
Right.
But then it's like, wait, what would happen if we go back and see who Frank was? We actually get to meet his daughter. We see a little bit of what that relationship was and be with him as he's losing her. And then all of a sudden, I think you like Frank even all that much more. You're like, stop beating up on yourself. Let go. Try and let go of this. But how could he possibly let go? So hopefully it makes him more relatable and more sympathetic, I think.
Now, speaking of reveals and twists, the big one obviously is that Sydney was, you know, kind of responsible for the plane crash in the first place.
Yes.
And, you know, once that episode, it's basically an hour long flashback, that episode, in episode 8, I believe.
The full episode.
Yeah. And that made me want to go back and rewatch the season all over again with that knowledge in mind. Can you talk about the decision to do that?
You know, originally, I love a good twist at the end. Yeah. I love a good Kaiser Soze or, you know, I see dead people, you name it. Like, I love those hooks. But because it's a series, it felt like we originally were thinking that might be the end of the season.
Oh,
my God, she walks out and we realize she's behind all this. But then as a TV show, that felt like it would be gimmicky, like a hook, like come back next season, as opposed to giving the audience full resolution, ending this story, living with the fallout of that reveal for 2-3 more episodes. And that's why we decided to move it up. But I think everything we were doing all season long is building toward that. And I think if you watch it again, I do think you recontextualize and do see things that they're saying, things that she's talking about that all she's playing fair the whole time.
Right.
She's just withholding information like a good spy.
Now, since you mentioned that,
The
writing process of, you know, depicting these characters who are holding secrets and you kind of don't know exactly why or what their motivations are. And you're kind of writing a fine line where you don't want to frustrate the audience, but you do want to hold that back so then you can have those reveals later. What is that process like?
Painstaking, difficult, hard. It's why I have gray hair. It's never easy. It's always a back and forth with the room. It gets very confusing at times, you know, because we're talking about oh, we had this idea. Isn't that what we're doing? No, wait, we were going to, two weeks ago, we thought that was a good idea. So it's very much a chessboard of trying to orchestrate something that where the mechanism of the storytelling and the sort of twists, we can lay them out and we feel like we have a good forward throw that makes you want to come back into the next episode. But at the same time, it's all coming from character, you know, and right. That's the hard part, is making sure that either the bad guy that we're catching that week or what's happening in a person's story is all reflecting back on ultimately what the story is about, which is the characters.
Now, I want to talk inspirations, influences, because this has, you know, it kind of starts out with the plane crash. Obviously, the first thing that comes to mind is like Lost or Yellow Jackets or anything along those lines. And then it kind of turns into this Jason Bourne kind of thriller, paranoia, conspiracy, like I mentioned before. What did you guys have in mind specifically?
Look, that crash was always sort of, here's our opener, right? Sure. We'll do a really fun sort of plane crash and set loose the concept of the show, which is, it's not just a manhunt, it's sort of exponential manhunt, right, with a guy who has never faced something like this before. But the influences are kind of all over the place. Yeah. It goes, for me, like 70s thrillers from Alan Pakula, All the President's Men, and Zigzag, and these strange thriller movies, to the action movies of the 90s, which were really more kind of high concept, the ones that we're referencing here. Okay. They're sort of a big hook to get you into it. And then character mysteries almost. I think this show's almost as much of a mystery as it is a thriller. And you look at something like Presumed Innocent, you know, which isn't a direct comp for this, but it's such an influence in terms of like, oh, there's a great twist, there's great characters, and you're sort of always wondering who they really are. And so it's a whole stew of strange influences that hopefully come together and feel unified.
Absolutely. Now, my final question for you.
Sure.
Whenever I'm watching a new show, again, I'm always thinking, how are they going to put in a season two tease and that sort of thing? Yeah. Are they going to play it straight, just kind of, you know, have it self-contained, make it a limited series, or, you know, leave those breadcrumbs? And I kind of feel like you did a little bit of both, but that last, in the finale, there's a little tease there.
There's a little tease.
Can you talk about whether, you know, there was any discussions ahead of time with Apple that, yes, we're going to do a season two if this performs well? What were those?
You know, I hope that if it does well, I'm sure I would hope Apple would want more. But what's important to me, and I think to all the writers, is to tell a story that feels complete, right? Nothing is more frustrating to me than getting to the end of a season of a show and there's some big hook that you're like, wait, I got to come back to. And then I come back like 2 years later and I go, what had happened? Why do I care? So this, to me, I think each episode, I hope, feels like its own movie and it's closed and you get a resolution. And I hope the whole season feels that way. It does to me that we're resolving all the questions we're answered. Yes, might there be, you know, a hanging chad that's not resolved? Yes. But I don't think that, I hope people can feel like they had a full meal and are satisfied with this at the end.
John, mission accomplished.
Okay, good. Oh, great.
Congrats on the season. You guys did great.
Joining me now is Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
Hey, Brad. All right. So we have a couple movies to talk about here, and I have not seen one of them. And that is it Fackham Hall? That's how it's written. But I heard you pronounce this differently on an episode.
Yeah, I said it with like a little bit of a British accent because I said Fackham Hall. But yeah, Fackham Hall is the American way to say it.
Okay. I didn't know if that was like some sort of pun. Like if you pronounce it that way, it kind of sounds like fuck them all. You know what I'm saying? Like fuck them all. Like,
yeah, that's the point. That's actually the point. Okay. Yeah.
All right. I didn't realize that when I just read the title and like watched the trailer for this movie, like that joke just completely went over my head. So sorry if I'm an idiot and didn't get that, but just throwing that out there in case any of our listeners needed that little extra push as well. But what did you think about this movie?
I think this movie is so much fun. It's so funny. It's right in line with The Naked Gun and like the classic spoof style. I'm actually so excited that we got both this and The Naked Gun this year. It feels like there's a classic kind of parody comedy that's rising back up. And even though like The Naked Gun wasn't like a runaway hit, it did pretty decently at the box office. I'm not sure how this one is going to do because it's a little bit more, I think, of a niche audience. It's hitting like period drama, British period drama. It feels like it most closely skews to Downton Abbey and shows and movies of its ilk, but it does venture into some like Hercule Poirot territory in one part of the movie, and it really does capture just like the general vibe of British period drama. So like, even if you haven't watched Downton Abbey, you'll still definitely get like what this movie is going for, and it's still very funny because it just has like hilarious, silly, stupid jokes in it. So many like puns and like literal translations of like lines, and just very silly stuff, the kind of stuff you want, that you love from movies like Airplane and Young Frankenstein and whatnot. So yeah, this was, I just had so much fun watching this.
I was just reminded when you're talking about this type of comedy maybe being ascendant again, I've totally forgot that there's a new scary movie that's supposed to be in development or coming out maybe next year or something. So like, that's another example of that type of comedy, I guess, that's going to be on display on the big screen for people. So
yeah, and I hope they can pull that one off too, because the scary movie franchise kind of took a dive after the first couple. So I'm hoping that maybe they can capture some of that magic and get back into what made the originals so good.
Yeah. Well, I, like I said, have not had a chance to see Falcon Hall yet. I think this is probably going to be a home watch for me, honestly. Like, at this time of year, it's just, I mean, I know I feel bad because, like, I'm always talking about trying to support theatrical comedies as much as possible, but it's just, like, such a busy time of year with the holidays and everything, and then, like, all of the awards movies that, I mean, Cry Me a River, like, this is not, this is very much a first world problem.
I have to watch
problem.
So many screeners, and I love my family. Fuck off, Ben.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, there's just, like, so much stuff to watch that gets crammed in at the end of the year, and I fear that Fac-A-Mole is probably going to fall by the wayside for me, but I am interested in this, so I'll probably check it out maybe, like, early next year or something. But
and similar to The Naked Gun, too, and I talk about this with the filmmaker, they did the, you know, what they should do by not casting full-on comedians, with one exception, which I do talk about in the movie, and there's a good reason for it, and it works very well. But, like, you have Damian Lewis and Thomasin McKenzie and Catherine Waterston in the leads. Tom Felton from the Harry Potter franchise is here, being a little bit of a douche nozzle. And, yeah, it's so much fun. I really just I like this a lot.
Okay, well, you had a chance to speak with Jim O'Hanlon, the director of this movie. Is there anything else you wanted to say about the film before we just jump right into your conversation with him?
No, I don't think so. But I hope that if you guys have the time and it's playing near you, like, please go see it. Like, this is the kind of movie that, you know, you want to support, and so that we get more comedies in theaters again. I miss the experience of seeing you know, comedies with large crowds and having this like shared experience of just laughing. You know, it's completely different than sitting at home by yourself and watching a comedy. You have so much more fun in theater, so please go out and see it.
Absolutely. All right, here is Brad's conversation with Falcon Hall director Jim O'Hanlon.
Loved watching Falcon Hall.
Enjoy it.
Yeah, so funny. It's especially great to get two you know, really classic style spoof movies in the same year, between this and The Naked Gun. You know, I've missed these kind of movies. So it was great to watch one of these again.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They haven't been on the big screen for a while, or the small screen. We haven't had them for quite a while. And so, yeah, to have two like buses, isn't it?
It's fantastic. Yeah.
Come along at once.
So I wanted to start off with just by asking, what were some of the earliest comedies that you remember latching on to?
Well, I grew up on sort of British TV comedy. So, you know, a series, I don't know if you've got in the States, so just like Blackadder with Rowan Atkinson, The Young Ones, which was a sort of anarchic sitcom about some daft students, written by Ben Elton, and with, you know, lots of people, big actors that became big. We loved The Young Ones. We loved Only Fools and Horses, all those kind of clips. 40 Towers was my biggest one. I watched that with my dad when I was about 9 or 10, and we just loved it. We watched it over and over again. I've just shown my own kids and they loved it as well. So the sort of the farces played very straight. Now that I talk about those, I go, oh yeah, that's probably where my interest in ridiculous, ludicrous, over the top, daft comedy, but played with a totally straight face, comes from. And so then I kind of graduated onto film stuff like Airplane and Blazing Saddles and, you know, the early Naked Guns, Police Squad, because I recently, not recently, 10 years ago, I directed a TV series, a series of three films that were spoof detective dramas.
Written
by Charlie Brooker of Black Mirror fame, and really funny spoof detective dramas that were sort of the British period, British detective drama version of Police Squad, really.
Right.
And they were really fun to do. So there was a kind of a lineage, all of them taking it desperately seriously. That was the fun of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we just talked about kind of like how the spoof hasn't exactly been popular for a while. You know, at least in, I don't know if it's been the same way in the UK.
No, same here. Yeah.
So like, what made you feel like this one could work in today's landscape?
Yeah, it's interesting because I've always loved them, you know, and Touch of Cloth was it was a great success, but it was in the early days of Sky that we did that, and it didn't have a huge viewership, and you know, the people who saw it absolutely loved it, and I always felt there was the kind of appetite for that. And I had talked to Charlie about doing some other stuff in that sort of spoof area, and we never quite took that any further. So when Chris came to me with this, with Fackham Hall, I just first of all thought, you know, it was very, very funny, right? Yeah. First of all, whether it's a spoof, whether it's a romantic comedy, whatever it is, if it's not funny, it doesn't matter what the genre is, it's not funny, right? Yeah. So this was immediately like laugh out loud funny. And there was a huge variety of jokes, and there was slapstick, and there was sophisticated jokes, and there were totally unsophisticated, silly jokes, and there were, you know, visual jokes, and there's musical jokes, and there's all sorts of stuff. So that was the first thing, is I thought it was really funny. Second of all, I thought, why has nobody done a spoof period drama? It feels right. Like it's ripe. And so in the current climate, I suppose I feel a genre has to be quite ubiquitous in order for you to want to spoof it, and in order for a spoof to work. If there's only one or two of them, it's never going to work.
Right.
So it has to be. So we've got Upstairs, Downstairs. This isn't a Downton Abbey spoof, really. You don't have to have watched 1 second of Downton Abbey to enjoy Fackham Hall.
Right.
But if you've watched a lot of Downton Abbey or period dramas, I think you might enjoy it even more. You know, because of course you'll recognize the tropes, you'll recognize the archetypes, you'll recognize the character, and actually people who've never watched Downton Abbey probably recognize the tropes because they're familiar from lots of other period dramas. Yeah. You know, so I think it felt like we were at just over the crest of peak period British period drama, and that's a good point to take something on when it's just at its peak and about to kind of come down. That's a really nice point to go. Everyone knows them. Everyone knows the tropes. And now is the time to take the mick out of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And poke fun at them.
The title itself obviously is meant to sound like a dirty phrase. Were there ever any other titles that were considered for that?
That was always the title. And, you know, I call it Fackham Hall because I'm Irish, so it doesn't work so well in my accent. It works much better in a British accent.
Yeah.
So that was always, you know, that was one of the three things. Chris, who I'd worked with, the producer, said, I've got this great script, I'd love you to read. And I liked Chris very much and I trusted him. And then he said, it's a spoof Downton Abbey. And I thought, okay, that's funny. Nobody's ever done that. And that feels very original. And then he said, it's called Fackham Hall. And I was like, okay, that's just brilliant. That's genius. And then he said, it's Jimmy Carr and the Dawson Brothers. Those four, I was like, I'll read the script, but I'm in, but I will read the script. And then the script was brilliant. I loved it.
So did Jimmy and his brother Patrick and the Dawson brothers all work together on the script then? Because I initially was like, oh, maybe one of them did a first draft and then someone rewrote, because that feels like a lot of writers for a single script.
Yeah, so Jimmy and Patrick had the idea, I think, initially. They said, why don't we do a spoof Fackham Hall, a spoof period drama? And they brought that to Chris, and he thought it was a great idea. And then they brought the Dawson brothers in, who had worked with Jimmy, because Jimmy obviously hadn't written a full movie, and the Dawsons had. They had worked on some of Judd Apatow's stuff, and they had written a lot of TV comedy. So they came in, and so I think it was a variety. Their process was the Dawsons always write together, but then they would go back and forth with Jimmy and Patrick, and you know, they would all try and come up with a better joke for something, or you know, we have a voiceover in the end, and Jimmy would write a draft, and then the boys would kind of shape it and move it. So it was quite fluid, I think, between them.
Yeah.
And then obviously I came in as well and kind of suggested other jokes, or, you know, I directed period drama. So I did a 4-part adaptation of Emma for the BBC and and PBS in America. And I brought my experience of directing the tropes of Jane Austen or other period drama. So it's definitely not a pure Downton Abbey spoof in any way. It's more period dramas. And I think they work very much together and with me. And then, of course, that steamrolls and I bring in the art department and say, guys, we need funny signage for the back of this scene. And the writers would come up with ideas and the art department would come up with ideas. And, you know, between us all, we ended up with the film we ended up with.
Yeah, it's so much fun. And like, because the spoof isn't exactly like what hasn't been popular, did you have a hard time finding the actors who were willing to like do something this silly?
Well, interestingly, we didn't really. I mean, we sent it to, I think Thomason was the first person we sent it. Thomason McKenzie plays Rose. And she said to me when I met her, like, I was going on holiday. I said, I shouldn't really read this, but I'll have a quick look because the title seems fun. And she said, I read it the whole way over on the plane to my holiday. I read it in one sitting, was snorting with laughter. And the person beside me going, what is it? And reading bits out. I know I shouldn't have, but I was reading bits out to my friend. And I just thought, I want to do it. And we had a similar response. Catherine Waterson said the same to me. I play soccer with Damien, with a dad soccer group on a Sunday morning. So I sent it to him and said, you know, no pressure, but what do you think of this? And he said, this is really funny. I'd love to be involved. So actually, it was just the funniness of the script, really, that made people go. And also, I do think those guys also grew up on Airplane and Naked Gun and Blazing Saddles and, you know, Hot Shots and those kind of thing and Top Secret. And they felt like, wow, we haven't seen this for a long time and it feels really fresh. And it's not just a reboot of some previous IP. This is an entirely new, fresh and original film.
Yeah.
That finally is just really funny.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Akiva Schaffer, who directed the Naked Gun remake, said that he didn't want to cast any people who were known for comedy. It seems like you mostly followed that path, too, with the exception of Jimmy Carr's cameo.
Yeah, correct. Exactly correct. And I had done the same on A Touch of Cloth. We you know, my Touch of Cloth had John Hannah, Saran Jones, Brian Cox. Yeah. You know, we had an amazing cast. And so the same here. I wanted people who, if you turned the sound down and you were watching this, you would think you were watching a new British period lavish costume drama.
Yeah.
And the kind of people who you would, if I was doing the real version of this and I had those characters, I would also be looking at Damien for that role and at Thomason for that role and Tom Felton. You know, you could, all of those people could totally play the serious version and you would 100%. Be delighted. You'd be like, oh my God, it's amazing. But once I met them and chatted to them, I also needed to know they would understand where the funny was and not play it so straight that you lose all the comedy. So
right.
It is played straight, but you know, the famous thing in Spinal Tap where he says, this one goes up to 11. Mm-hmm. I say to them, this one goes up to 10 and a half. It's very slightly skewed. It's not big. It's not hammed, but it has to have an awareness of where the comedy is. And largely where the comedy is in terms of the performances is in playing it super serious.
Yeah, 100%.
Super, no matter how daft the stuff going on, they just carry on like the Titanic is sinking beneath them, but they are still going to play this like their lives depend on it and they think they can win an Oscar for best actor, you know?
Yeah.
So they are acting their socks off in the real version while this ludicrous nonsense, and they're speaking ludicrous nonsense and there's comedy happening in the background. They've got to act as if it's not happening.
Yeah. And now one thing I was curious about, did you guys have to do any adjustments to make certain jokes work better for American audiences? Were there any alternate versions? Because the one I thought was when you see the map and there's names like Jonah Hill and Ricky Lake and Carrie Underwood, those felt like geared towards more American audiences. So I was wondering if there were any other jokes maybe that were like that.
No, interestingly, those were definitely aimed to be, you know, things that would work in both the US and the UK. So we were trying to find all those names would be very big in the UK as well. So they completely work. there's, I'd say, two or three jokes that probably won't work for Americans. There's a joke about Blackpool and the Blackpool Tower that plays on the fact that Blackpool Tower looks a bit like the Eiffel Tower. So that joke doesn't necessarily travel. And then Skegness, there's a joke about Clacton and Skegness, which are these sort of slightly down at heel, you know, English seaside resorts.
Oh, okay.
That might not be, with respect to the people of those areas, might not be considered the most glamorous holiday resorts in the world.
Yeah.
They may not travel. But by and large, I think it was about a shared cultural experience, really, and that most stuff, I would say most of the stuff, American audiences will, I mean, outside of those two jokes,
right?
We have another 300 jokes or so that they will get.
Now, were there any deleted scenes that you were bummed to cut from the movie, even if you knew it ultimately made the final cut better?
Yeah, there were a lot. There's a great, and I feel sorry for Adam and Lily, who play Bert Chester and Fifi Valentine. They had their own little story.
Oh, okay.
And in a way, it was the very fact that it was its own story that didn't tie into the central love story and didn't tie into the central murder mystery and didn't tie into the central story of the fate of Fackham Hall itself. It was a really funny story, and he kept getting caught in flagrante with various different people. He was the kind of parody of the cad. Now, that hopefully you've seen the movie, some of that is still in there.
Yeah,
sense of him as the cad, but they had lots of scenes, and they were really funny scenes and brilliantly performed. So particularly for those two, I felt a little sorry for them. And there are some jokes I wake up at night and I think, oh, I should have left that one in.
Yeah.
There was a nice joke about the trope of the hand that takes out the dagger, and we had played on that a lot, and I think I wish we'd been able to keep that in. There were definitely a number of jokes that and scenes that you just felt this has got to be sort of, it runs at about 95 minutes, which I think is about right. And they you just if you lose the momentum of the audience following the story, it doesn't matter how funny it is, it's hard to pull that back.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of, I mean, we'll do a DVDs extra someday and you'll see
awesome.
Them and they're really funny.
Well, as I wrap up, I wanted to ask one last thing, because there was one just last bit joke I was like, man, that's such a great like dig, is when you have the text epilogues for all the characters, and it's and it makes it clear that Jimmy Carr's character is basically Hitler.
Well, we couldn't help noticing that he had a little mustache and he had sort of 1930s hair, and that he was playing a sort of a priest. And so yes, they were fun to write. That was the sort of last. I had that idea in the middle of filming. I thought, oh, a funny credit thing would be to do those sort of, you know, faux serious, this is what became of all the characters, but make them really silly. I'd say,
and
yes,
Jimmy's whole bit like that he does reading those things, that I've never seen a bit like that before. That was hilarious.
Enjoy it.
Yeah
he was great. We were looking for a cameo for Jimmy, and I was like, look, this is almost like how Jimmy's thing is, which is absolutely straight-faced, you know, absolutely po-faced and serious, but very funny and silly and all about comic timing. And I was like, who better than Jimmy Carr to play that part? He's going to nail it. And he did. It one of the funniest sequences in the film, I think.
Yeah, so good. Well, it gave me the light, but it was great talking to you, Jim. Love the movie. And yeah, I can't wait to see more from you.
Thank you very much, Brad. Tell your friends.
I will, absolutely. Take it easy.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
And then, Brad, before we go, you had a chance to talk to Kevin Smith again. We had him on the podcast earlier this year for his, I guess, re-release of Dogma. And we had the opportunity to talk to him again. And of course, you're going to jump at that, right?
Yeah, exactly. I will always take an opportunity to talk to Kevin Smith, because the guy likes to talk, and I still love him as a dude. And even if I'm not the biggest fan of all of his more recent movies, all of his older movies will still hold a special place in my heart. And talking to him is legitimately always a joy. Like, he's just a good dude, and it's a fun conversation. We talk about Dogma, we talk about the development of Dogma 2. As a follow-up from when we talked to him last time about Dogma 2, we finally get confirmation on who he wants to play the devil in Dogma 2, so that's great. And we also get a little information on another bit of casting that will be
replacing the late Alan Rickman as the Metatron in the movie. So that's pretty cool. And yeah, it's just it's a cool, you know, conversation. It was nice to actually have more time with him just to like have a little more laid back talk about stuff. And yeah, I hope you guys like it.
Awesome. Yeah, it's like one of those things where he talks so much that you probably only got through half of the questions that you were preparing to talk to him about the first time anyway. So at least you had a follow-up to be able to kind of get some of those follow-up questions.
Yeah, honestly, the last time we had like just 5 minutes, so I literally only wrote like one question.
Yeah, awesome. All right, well, here is Brad's second conversation this year with Kevin Smith.
What's up, Kev? How's it going?
So good. How are you, Bradford?
I'm good. I'm talking to you, so I'm feeling great.
Well, hold that thought, because at the end you might be like, you know what? He never had anything to say, and he has even less to say as an adult.
I think that's probably like the least accurate thing you could say about Kevin Smith.
True. That's true. Let me remodify. He has nothing of value to say. My God, he can talk. He's an orphan.
Now, I wanted to ask, as you were overseeing the 4K restoration of Dogma, were you ever tempted to pull a George Lucas and fix things you were unhappy with in the final cut or add deleted scenes back into the movie for like a special edition?
Never, by virtue of the fact that like I've always been, and this is my own private code, like I don't hold other filmmakers to this, and I don't want to get in an argument with half of the internet about whether I'm right about this or wrong. But for me, when I put the movie out there, that's the movie. So I've always been happy over the years to show you what we omitted as deleted scenes, but I rarely ever reincorporate. We did it once with Mallrats just because there was a whole half hour. And, you know, most people, when they watch that extended Mallrats cut on the 15th anniversary DVD, are like, there's a reason you cut all that shit. Like, it's not a superior movie by any stretch of the imagination. So I've always felt like the movie you commit to as the filmmaker is the movie. And, you know, not in a way where I'm like, and you should never touch it. Others want to do it. That's great. For me, I'm like, could be lazy. Could be like, no, I'm done. I ain't going back in and stuff.
Yeah.
So there's always that. But more importantly, I was like, I'm going to take the movie out on tour, sit there, watch it with people, overcharge them to watch a movie with me, and then talk afterwards. Like, those people want to see the movie they saw, you know, the one that they remember is in their head and hearts, that they watched with their grandma who took them to see it, you know, and didn't tell their parents. Where they watched on a first date and they wound up getting married. And now they got 3 kids. And I would think like, if you suddenly go like, and here's other stuff, it's just not quite the same experience. So I was like, let's just let it be what it always was. Like, yeah. You know, rather than reincorporate, like there was a temptation to reincorporate Jason Lee's character, Azrael, has a big speech about hell. Problem is I like lifted that speech wholesale from Neil Gaiman's Sandman. So even now, later in life, I'm like, well, I mean, it's an obvious like theft. It's not even an homage, for heaven's sake. It's plagiarism. So that was easy to like leave out. But if I was going to change anything, alter anything, it wouldn't be like, I want to add a scene that we cut. It would be I would have to shoot new material. There's a scene every night when I would watch it on tour that I was like, something's missing. And it's the scene where George Carlin plays Cardinal Glick. And he's like, the Catholic Church does not make mistakes. And then Chris Rock goes, please, what about the church's silent consent to the slave trade? And then Linda goes, and their platform of non-involvement during the Holocaust. Then he goes, all right, mistakes were made. But every night when I watched it, I was like, something's missing from that list. Something that wasn't a big thing when the movie was made back in 98, 99. But something is like blatantly missing if you're going to complain about the Catholic Church in 2025. And that was the only thing I was like, man, if I can go back in time and be like, oh yeah, and all the pederasts, you know, which we found out about back in the day. And that would be the only thing I would like to alter. Because as I watched it every night, I was like, you know, you get the sense that a modern audience would be like, one more. Like, those things are bad, but one more.
That makes sense. Now, there was, back in the day, there was a comic book series called Chasing Dogma that filled in the gap for Jay and Silent Bob between Chasing Amy and Dogma. And a chunk of that actually ended up being used in part of the story for Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. Because you have the Quick Stops comic book that's happening right now, have you thought about doing a comic that fills in the gap between Jay and Silent Bob Reboot and Dogma 2, or would it just pick up so close to that movie?
It could. We could easily. What a great idea. I love with the Quick Stops comics, which I do at Dark Horse for our imprint of Secret Stash Press. You get to tell these little stories that you wouldn't otherwise. Chasing Dogma, which was just like, that was the name of it when we compiled it. It was the Jane Silent Bob miniseries, right? That was like me when I first started out in comics. I was like, we can do anything. This would be great. Let's like tell the story when they leave Chasing Amy and go to Dogma. And it was like such a fun thing to do. Now, I mean, honestly, like the first, as you say that, I was like, my God, what a great way that would be to hand off to Dogma. If for no other reason, been like, we did it again. Like, yeah. Oh, they did it years ago. How nice. I'm going to think about that, man. That's a good idea.
Awesome. Yeah. And I was very happy that you guys did this.
The Chasing Amy one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, Quick Stops Volume 3 has been, I love all of the Quick Stops thus far, all the volumes. But the Volume 3 has been very meaningful, very emotional for me, because there's a whole like Chasing Amy issue, like you just pointed out, that is basically the comic book that Holden shares with Alyssa at the end of the movie. In the movie, you only ever saw one page in the cover. And then me and John Sprengelmeyer did the whole book. And it's just almost like one of those old Marvel, like, you know, Star Wars adaptations, like where it's just like, oh, it's the whole movie in the comic book. So I loved doing that. And it plays like a prop too. So it doesn't say our credits in the front. It says,
that's my favorite thing, because I love in-universe things and I hate when they ruin it by like slapping a tiny logo on it somewhere. I'm so glad you made it so clean, like exactly how it's
going. We went hard, man, just by virtue of the fact both me and God bless him, Sprengelmeyer, was just like, let's keep the joke. Like, let's, you know, we can bury our credits at the end and stuff. So that was lovely. The second issue we did was the Shannon homage issue, the Mallrats issue. And then the third one we just did, which I loved, and I honestly feel is probably like the best of all the books thus far, is the Requiem, it's called, the Alan Rickman, the Metatron issue. Yeah. Jay and Silent Bob steal the Buddy Christ statue and encounter Metatron for the first time since Dogma. And it was wonderful because I got to play with the toys again, but I got to play with the toy that I'll never get to play with again. And comics are fantastic for that. You know, can't put Alan in a flick anymore. I mean, I guess you could, but it'd be distasteful in this AI world and stuff. Somebody will one day down the road, I'm sure. But you can like go nuts in a comic book. And we did, and it was a bittersweet little story, man, that ties in not just Dogma, but shouts out Clerks 3. So I could definitely get my head around like doing that in advance of the Dogma sequel as well, a lead up, if you will.
Yeah. Speaking of Alan Rickman, both him and George Carlin sadly aren't with us anymore. Have you thought about how you'll honor them in the new Dogma movie?
A lot. I mean, Cardinal Glick dies in Dogma.
That's right. Yeah.
So we'll, you know, he'll get shout out. There will be a portrait of the dead, like they're all portraits of all dead popes. But Alan is trickier, man. But I think I found a way. And it depends when I shoot it, and it also depends if the person I haven't. I want to write it for Helen Mirren.
Oh, okay.
And she is
perfect.
Incredibly Alan adjacent. Now she's not playing Metatron, but she plays this movie's version of Metatron. And it would be, you know, for me, I met her years ago with Alan at this Empire Movie Awards ceremony. And I don't know, when I was thinking like, well, I don't have Alan. At one point I was like, well, Adam Driver looks like a young Alan Rickman, just taller. But then I was like, no. And then I thought like, you know what? Helen Mirren, aside from being like one of my favorite actors on the planet, like I had that crossover moment with her and Alan at one point. You know, as a writer and a romantic, you'll make any connection or any justification you can. But it started me thinking, I was like, maybe it'll be Helen Mirren. So I'm writing it for Helen Mirren.
That would be perfect. Now, I wanted to follow up on something we talked about last time, and you weren't ready to reveal it yet. I wonder if we're in a different place now, because you said the devil plays a big part in this movie. Are you able to say who you have in mind for that role yet?
Yes. I worked with a kid years and years ago, and he was so sweet, a nice boy and stuff, very talented. And then he went and became like super famous. Whenever I write the devil, I think of Austin Butler.
You know what? Someone who listened to the podcast guessed that. And I was, as soon as I heard it, I was like, yeah, that's got to be it.
Especially after Dune, man.
Like, yeah.
His fade was pretty badass. But our devil is, you know, he's not like arched eyebrow insidious.
Right.
He's sexier than that. And Austin really, he's like a grunge rocker.
Awesome.
and I think Austin could pull that off pretty well.
That sounds amazing. Now, in today's box office environment, do you think Dogma 2 can get a theatrical release? You know, or would you take it on tour yourself? Would you be satisfied with a streaming release?
I honestly could care less. Like, a guy like me would welcome a streaming release, because that has always been my least favorite aspect of the movie making process, is going to market with it. You know, yeah. Trying to convince people to go see it in the theater. Like, having Netflix just be like, hey, it's on. Like, oh my God, what a dream that would be. Especially because I'll take it from there. Like, you know, I've always been my own best self-promoter and stuff. So, like, I'll have live screenings and play it in my movie theater, and you can all come and join and stuff like that. I will eventize it for my audience the way I know how. But I would more than welcome somebody being like, you know, oh, we'll stream it. Don't worry about all that marketing shit like that. That was always the most irritating part of the process, was like being a low budget filmmaker, where, like in the case of Clerks 2, 5 million, we kept the budget down to 5 million bucks, which is, you know, weird because the first one was 27 grand. But with all, you know, paying people and shit like that and having a set and what that wasn't free, we kept the budget down to 5 million. And like, I had to ask people to like cinch their belts and not ask for as much money as they normally get. And then they just poured $20 million in marketing all over it to sell the movie. And that always like outraged me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not obtuse. I understand you need to, you know, sell in order to make money and stuff. But like, those figures were incongruous. It's like, flip that. It would have been nice to have $20 million to make the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Sell it for five. Like, you know, use five to sell it. And I'll tub thump and I'll go out there and cheer and stuff. But now marketing is like completely different than when I entered the field. In general, like, now you would never buy a TV ad. Why would you? Who watches television?
Now, what is the status of the Dogma 2 script? Is it finished? Are you doing rewrites? Yeah.
Still writing, because I dip in and out. What happens is, like, you'll go on a run and you're like, oh my God, this is wonderful. And then life and something where it's like, I've got 5 weeks of shows, which take me, I'm home from like Monday till Thursday, and then from Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, I'm usually in some city on the road doing 2 comedy gigs a night. So when you do that, you know, concentration is broken, and then you've got other things that you're spinning plates on where you turn your attention to. So there's 30 pages that I'm very happy with. And then I jumped over to this other thing that I have been nurturing for a while that I put aside because I was like, ooh, Dogma 2, new thing. And started that. So I'm between a few of them at the moment.
Can you talk about what that other thing is, or is it not ready yet?
It's not ready yet, but it's a period piece. And it's the, you know, it's how to put this. So I can't wait to go out there with a Dogma follow-up. But it will just be a Dogma follow-up.
Right.
You know, it'll exist because the Dogma exists.
Yeah,
this thing I'm writing is like whole cloth new and nothing that I'd normally do, and it has me kind of excited, because it's, you know, there's some people, not many left because not many give a shit anymore, but some people have always been waiting for me to like grow up as a filmmaker, and I'm writing a thing where I was like, oh, this feels like a grown-up thing.
Okay.
This feels like a movie that like grown-ups would enjoy. I don't even know, you know, where it would go, for heaven's sakes, because they don't play movies like it in the movie theater anymore.
Right.
But we'll see. Right now I'm just kind of appreciating the process, you know, and trying not to overthink it, because I'm page 50 and I was like, now wait a second, I should be further along at this point in the story. But I'm like, you know what? Relax. Just let it be what it's going to be, man. It's going to, you'll get where you're going meant to go, and just enjoy the process for the moment. So I've been enjoying it. It's been a good time.
That's great. I want to ask you about something that I feel like not a lot of people are going to care about, but I was interested in this and I know you are too. I saw your video about your Rocky and Bullwinkle pinball machine that you purchased. Looks incredible.
Thank you.
I'm a big pinball fan. Are you like really getting into it now?
Good folks at Stern asked me to do a voice for the Dungeons and Dragons game.
Nice.
And I was like, yeah, absolutely. And when they were done, they were like, we'll give you a table or a machine. And I said, oh, well, I don't give a shit about Dungeons and Dragons. Can I get that Jaws game you guys make? And they're like, yeah, okay. And so they sent me the Jaws pinball machine. What a game changer.
Yeah.
Like, now you got to remember, kids, I'm 55. So, you know, I was around when pinball was around in the beginning. When before, you know, even Pong, before, let alone Super Mario or even Pac-Man, an arcade was pinball.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've seen pinball and interacted with it a few times since I was a kid, or since the 70s or 80s. But suddenly having full access to a pinball machine, and a fantastic one at that, and the Jaws game is absolutely brilliant, well designed, nostalgic as hell. But it's a nostalgia driver. The sentimentality that you feel just by like going back to something as simple as you versus gravity, which is really all pinball is so unbelievably gratifying and turns your clock back. I don't know how else to say it, but it makes me feel young. When I sit there and play pinball, I have a good time. It's frustrating as fuck. I'll be honest with you. I got to a place recently where I took the glass out of a game so that I could play the ball that way and stop it from going down the right lane. I was like so close to breaking the glass, but I was like, don't break the glass. Remove it. It's your arcade. You can do whatever the fuck you want. So I was warned early on. They were like, these things multiply. Be careful.
Yeah.
And now I've got three tables. I got a Stern X-Men table, the Jaws Stern table, machine by Stern. And I've got the Rocky and Bullwinkle game from Data East that they did back in like 93, which has held up incredibly well.
And yeah, it looks like it was in great condition.
Really great condition. And I play it a lot, man. I had my boys, the game doctors came in. Ryan said he had to flip a diode because one of my flippers was like going up and not coming back down and stuff. But other than that, man, I've had no problems with the game. But it was such a, pun intended, game changer, man. Like I had no idea how much I was missing a pinball machine in my life.
Yeah.
And now I'm complete. No. But it's fun. It's like, and honestly, when you've been married as long as I've been married, fundamental activity you do the most, sadly, is not fucking. It's watching TV together.
Yeah.
Watching stuff. Pinball has opened up this whole other, like, fucking avenue where it's like, you want to go play some pinball? I'm like, yeah. And so she'll play Jaws and I'll play Bullwinkle. And, you know, we put on some 80s music, man.
Yeah.
Drink some soda, have some pizza. And we're kids, you know, it's your own little like pizza parlor circa late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I absolutely love it. Frustrating as fuck, though.
Yeah. I have a friend who opened up an arcade here in our small town, and he's a big pinball fan. And so now they have a bunch of machines. They always get the newest ones. And he got me really into it. And it's just, it's for a small town and for an arcade that's like, you know, an old school thing, it's doing very well. And people love the nostalgia. They're coming
pinball,
back. Like,
it's weird. Pinball, and I'm certainly not declaring anything anybody doesn't know because I've seen it pop up in media a lot lately. But pinball is enjoying a moment again.
Yeah.
And it probably has a lot to do with the same reason that I, you know, am into it and stuff. You know, I think in a world that ever pushes towards AI, you know, something that's a little more a game, but tactile, that, you know, isn't just zeros and ones, is a, you know, for those of us who don't like go out and whack balls around, it's a fun pastime. It's you know, and a fairly legit sport, man. Next move for me is to get into competitions.
It's fun.
Like, they do it. I've heard, and I'm like, that sounds fun, but I'm afraid that I'm not good enough. But you know, who cares? It's fucking good.
Exactly. Just have fun.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to ask you as I wrap up here: what are you watching lately that like has you inspired, or that you're just like loving and like you're really engaged with?
What? So on the chair company, like, you know,
I
Tim Robinson. He's so funny, and I, you know, I enjoyed Friendship quite a bit, but like you know, it's a question of how far you can stretch cringe humor, that type
right.
of humor. And I think the Chair Company does it wonderfully. Like, he's allowed to do what he does very well, and it serves the narrative without sticking out like a sore thumb. Not that I'm saying that's what happened in Friendship at all, but like, it's a tricky tightrope. And I think, like, I think they're going to win Emmys, man. Like, it's
I hope so.
Very original show. I started watching I Love LA, like the new Rachel Sennott show on HBO. I like that. It's off until next year, but High Potential has been enjoyable. Yeah. So, I talk about this every time I go out and do comedy clubs. Shocking how much Matlock I watch. not the old Matlock, you know. I'm not Andy Griffith, but the new Kathy Bates Matlock is so well written.
Yeah.
You know, it just reminds me of a comfortable old network procedural that was kind of all the standard when I was growing up and up until the last, I don't know, 10, 15, until streaming hit.
Yeah.
So it too has an air of like, not just nostalgia because it's called Matlock, but like, oh, like this is how they used to make shows. You know? They were all like this.
Yeah. These
little screws and stuff. What else have I been watching? Those are the ones that leap to mind.
Right on. Well, they gave me the light, so that's my time. But thanks so much, Kevin. It was great talking
to
you.
Such a pleasure, Brad.
Awesome stuff. And I can't wait to see Dogma 2 and whatever else you got in the works, man.
Coming, man. It's coming. I'm having a good time writing it. Hopefully people have a good time seeing it when it's done.
Heck yeah. All right, man. Take it easy.
I'll see you later.
So it was great talking to Kevin Smith, obviously, but we also wanted to pay our respects to him because not long after we had this interview on December 1st, Kevin Smith's mother sadly passed away. And obviously she was a big part of his life and she's appeared at various events with him and whatnot. And she was clearly just somebody who loved her son and supported him. And he's really feeling the grief and pain of that right now. So our much love and respect goes out to him and his family during this really difficult time.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wrote just a really beautiful tribute to his mom on his Instagram. So I encourage people to go seek that out. I was like getting teary at my computer just looking at this in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
Like just very powerful stuff. So you said it very well there, Brad. I think that's going to do it for today's episode of the show. You can find more about a lot of what we talked about at slashfilm.com. I'll try to link to some stuff in the show notes to make it easy for folks. You can subscribe to Slash Film Weekly on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out patreon.com/popculture to hear more from many of the folks you heard on this episode. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, everyone, and we'll talk to you next time.